Well, good morning. It is Mama D, and how are you today? That, what you just heard, was called The Gathering. Kim Vincent on guitar, Margie Carmichael accompanying him on guitar, Annie Bourne on with that haunting cello and the beautiful vocals. This is from one of my Christmas albums, and yes, it is now December. I can now play you some Christmas music. This is from the College of Piping and Celtic Performing Arts of Canada. It's called Ancestral Voices, A Celtic Christmas. This show is something a little different. From a reading at the Jane Bond, I spoke with new Canadian authors, brand new authors, I might add, Jen Farrell, Tracy Chapman, and Zoe Whittle, about their books, Sugarbush and Other Short Stories, King, and the poems of Emily Valentine. All three of these are brand new authors. And here's what we had to say to one another.
So, wow, ladies, are you having fun on your tour?
We're all kind of giddy.
now, where have you been so far, and how far do you still have to go?
This is our last night. Okay. Well, this is my last night.
I only have one more in Toronto.
One more in Toronto. So where have you girls all been?
Oh, well, that's
everywhere. Okay, up for this book tour. Where have you been?
Well, you guys went to Vancouver, right?
Vancouver, yeah.
And then we met in Montreal.
Montreal, yeah. At Hamilton.
Yeah,
well, now we're in KW. Back to Toronto.
Yeah, and then we're taking a break.
Yes.
Well, you know, you deserve one. You deserve one. You know, you got to spend some time writing, right?
That's the theory.
Or sleeping.
Or sleeping, or
detoxing. Yeah.
I want you ladies each to take a turn and introduce yourselves and tell us what book you've written and what inspired you with that particular book. This book that you're promoting on this tour.
All right, I'll go first. I'm Jen Farrell, and my book is called Sugarbush and Other Stories. It's my first book, and it's a collection of short fiction. And as such, the inspiration is just that I had enough short stories to finally put together into a book, I guess. That's the beauty of writing short stories. You just keep writing them, and then you think, oh, I guess I've got about 12 now. So, yeah, that's just sort of how it came together.
Excellent, excellent. Well, you know, when one of the ladies was up for a Giller Prize, it first was a book of short stories, too. Yeah. So, you know.
Yeah, can't front on short stories. I'm always cheering
right.
for them.
Okay, next up.
My name is Zoe Whittle, and I'm the author of a book of poetry called The Best 10 Minutes of Your Life, and I'm currently promoting my second book of poetry called The Emily Valentine Poem. And it's basically a collection of prose poetry and fan letters to 80s pop icons, and the prose poetry covers a variety of topics, mostly anxiety and femininity.
Excellent, excellent. And you, obviously, have written King.
Yes, my name is...
I got that one first. I've actually gotten through most of it and really enjoyed it, loved it.
Thank you.
Loved
thank you.
It.
Yes, thanks. Wow. I'm still kind of shocked that, like, it's a book and other people read it.
Do you ever look at it and you're like, it looks like a toaster or a tree?
But no, it's Superman. My name is Tanya Chapman, and yes, I wrote this book called King, and the inspiration behind it was, I don't know, gosh, boys who ride motorbikes and people who want to escape their lives and having fun and decisions that you make when you're no place to make a logical decision.
Interesting. Yeah. That's great. So what's the best thing about having been on this book tour, and what's the worst thing about having been on this book tour?
I'm just going to nix the worst right off the bat.
Okay.
I have no worst.
No
Excellent. Okay. Well, yeah. This is good.
This has been wicked. Touring with Zoe and Jen. Amazing. Fun. Like, great.
Great. So it's been kind of like a pajama party.
Basically, yeah. I mean, it's just been such a treat to like meet them both and read with them both, and yeah, Zoe and Tanya are awesome.
Good fit. Sorry.
No, that's totally okay. We do. I think we all fit really well together. The material, like as readers, it all goes together really well. It's been a really good time.
And I think the response has been really fun. Like after we read, there's always people coming up and that are happy, which
that's
is
great.
I mean, great. Yeah,
that's great. Alrighty. Well, if I were just not a perfect stranger to you, and we were just sitting and chatting, what would you like people to know about you?
Like personally, or
well, you know,
you have
a microphone and the freedom of speech to say anything you want.
Don't we always?
Well, you do, yeah. You do, and I do.
Yeah, but you're not always mic'd.
Oh, that's true. We just think we are.
See, you can say whatever you want, and it gets printed, but it also gets edited, doesn't it?
Yes, so. Thank God.
Amen.
Is that an amen? You're happy? You have good relationships with your editors?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. I feel like when I first started writing when I was 16, you know, there's this very not often naive assertion or assumption that you should, everything you write is genius, like, or this really exciting, you don't want to edit it, but then when you develop a good relationship with an editor who knows what they're doing, it's so amazing to see the steps that your work can go through, and it's so essential to have that eye that's not your own.
Yeah. I would agree with that with almost any kind of work.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, sometimes you just need somebody else to go, no. I paint, so when somebody goes, ooh, that's really dark.
oh yeah,
could be.
Yeah, Alana from Coach House is amazing. She took the book and then she gave me like 4 pages of notes, and I sat with them for a week before I did anything. And then I literally printed the book, took it all apart, rewrote it, put it all back together, and based on her notes, and it turned out to be the book that I wanted to write, but was almost there, or she saw like the real thing and the mess, and yeah, she's
excellent.
It was amazing. It was a great experience. You learn a lot, right?
Oh yeah.
That's great. So what things are you planning? Anything that you are, is there some idea that you are, you're thinking, you know, when this tour is done and I have some time to just sit and write, I will write about Santa Claus, the elves.
I've already got my second one started. Well, I'm 100 pages in, which really means 50.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, and it's like a, yeah, weird kind of cross-generational murder mystery literary thing.
Oh,
yeah,
that's great. I really enjoy murder mysteries. So.
Me too. Big fan. So should be
There's a lovely little, further down the street here, there's a lovely little bookstore called It's a Mysterious Affair, and all the handle is mystery books. And it's a beautiful little bookstore. I like that. Now, where would you rather see your books? At Chapters or at a smaller, cozier bookstore? Or, like, you know, do you have a preference? Do you just like to see 100 of your books stacked at...
Well, we were just at the bookshelf, and that was a great, great experience to see, you know, all the staff really behind all the books. And
people shopping at 9 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
People who actually, like, people who work there care about the books, the people who shop there care about the books. I mean, ultimately, I don't care, you know, where the book ends up. It just so happens that at independent retailers, I think, you know, they're the people who are going to put the books in the hands of the people, you know. They're going to be the ones who can sell it. It'd be nice to have 100 copies on a table at Chapters, but unfortunately, without the kind of word of mouth and the kind of support that a book really needs, a first book by a nobody such as myself, without that kind of support, a lot of those books just end up coming back, you know. So
places like Chapters don't know how to handle...
Well, I think
they prefer not to.
Well, it's a profit model, you know, and they're interested in selling things that move a lot and gift wrap and all sorts of lovely things. And I buy a lot of things at larger bookstores. I don't have a problem with that. But, I mean, yeah, I think it's partly up to the bookstores and it's partly up to people who read to go and find things that maybe aren't on the bestseller list. I make it a habit to just sort of go to a bookstore every once in a while and pick something off a shelf that I've never even heard of before and buy it.
I always go to the bargain bin first. Not so much because I'm cheap or anything like that, but that's stuff that doesn't get read as often.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's undiscovered. It's like hidden treasure.
And I found some really amazing hidden treasures.
That way. Although, of course, you know, if Zares wants to pick up the book and give me a distribution deal and put it beside InStyle, that's fine too.
Now.
Yeah, yeah. It feels like the last year has been such a whirlwind. I honestly haven't been reading very much because the book got picked up a year ago, and then all you do is get it back and turn it around and get it back and turn it around, and then you start reading like something that you really love, and then all of a sudden your characters start speaking in an Irish accent or something. So you have to, like,
that's totally true.
Hazel, you don't swear like a sailor. Oh, I gotta stop reading. Yeah.
Or there's chapters where you're like, clearly I wrote this when I was reading a lot of this.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
So try and steer clear.
So other people's writing when you're reading it can morph its way into your book.
Sure, if you love what you're reading, you get right into a book, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Or even if you're watching The Sopranos, God, you start swearing and hitting things for no reason at all.
Okay.
Nobody's in my trunk right now.
Is there any talk of releasing your book in the States? Any other countries, or are you still just looking at Canada?
I think it's really early. Like, we all just got published. Like, what are you, Jen? 2 weeks in?
Yeah. I'm hot off the press. Literally.
And I think I'm 3 weeks. So
about a month. Yeah.
A month. Yeah. So
wow.
It's, we're brand new babies.
Yeah.
So, yes, I would love it to be published
absolutely
all over the world.
Why
yes
not? Let's do this.
Yes.
Should I send copies?
I do want to plug my novel's coming out in April. It's called Bottle Rocket Hearts from Cormorant Books.
Excellent.
Yes.
Excellent.
And awesome title. Say that again.
Bottle Rocket Hearts.
Prepare and go, the angel said.
Was really beautiful. Wexford Carol, Ruth Sutherland. Again, that was off of Ancestral Voices. And you heard from the ladies and me. And all that background noise at the Jane Bond was just a large, I would say it was a fairly decent crowd. It was a decent crowd of people in and listening, drinking tea and eating some of that very, very superb hummus that they have there. And, while I was drinking tea, they had some fabulous, fabulous mint tea there. I was so happy with it. Although, not as wonderful as the mint tea that I had at the Almedina. Oh, gosh, best mint tea ever. Anyway, the ladies then proceeded to read a little bit from their books. And in this next segment, you're going to hear Tanya Chapman reading a chapter of King. Here you go.
Sissy and I are sitting at the kitchen table in her trailer. Sissy and Spiny's trailer looks a lot like mine, except it's tidier. Sissy tries to make hers look nice by buying new things for it all the time. Her idea of a new thing is anything that looks like it should be put in the space program, like the silver salt and pepper shakers on the black-topped glass table, or the clock that looks like it should have hands, but really it's digital. My trailer looks pretty much like it did when it was new in the 60s. I figure, why mess with a good thing? When I say that Sissy is mostly a never-ending talker, it's because some days like this, she hardly talks at all. She gets depressed. Depressed like she doesn't want to get out of bed. And on days like this, she needs me. Not that I can solve any of her problems, but I can convince her to get out of bed and make me a cup of tea, and that's more than she'd do otherwise. Spiny is no good for her in these times. He just gets frustrated or gets all over her, trying to make her feel better. Also, here's the kicker. It makes Sissy feel better to ask people questions they don't want to ask themselves. I think she likes to see us squirm. It's like she's feeling so crappy that she wants to make other people feel bad too, just so that she won't be alone with her sadness. This is the only time Sissy can be mean. But it's not really her asking the questions, not the Sissy that we know and love, it's someone else. It creeps in and you can't really do anything about it except wait it out and love her, despite the meanness. So I volunteer for the hot seat every time. Spiny, her boyfriend, can't handle that either. The hot seat, I mean. Hazel, she says. Why don't you learn how to cook? It's too late for me, Sissy. It's never too late. That's dumb. What do you think a stove is for, anyway? A place to set your drink when there's too many empties on the counter? She doesn't like that. She just stares at me and waits for me to say something serious. But as much as I love Sissy, I'm just not prepared to tell her I've never even seen the inside of my oven. Kim does all the cooking, and she knows it. So I drink my tea, which makes me think of the word teetotaler over and over, and I wait for the next question. Do you think that King has slept with lots of girls like the one he played cats with at old Joe's? I can't let my hurt show, or she will be on this topic all day. So I just think teetotaler, teetotaler, teetotaler again. But of course, I'm also wondering just how many cats girls he really did sleep with. But then for my own sanity, I decide that it doesn't matter since we got that all worked out anyway. I just nod at Sissy and sit very quietly and wait. Finally. Hazel, don't you want to have kids? What are you going to do when you have kids? You have to cook something then, you know. Sissy knows damn well that I don't want any kids, but Sissy wants kids. A lot of them. The thing is, she can't have them. I chalk it up to her acid birth. But now, I know it's bothering her. When she gets down, it's either the kid thing, or she thinks that there are too many bad vibes floating around her and she can't get away even if she runs real fast in her head. Those are her words, not mine. So now that I know it's a kid thing, I know the cure. I drag Sissy to the duster and head down to the farmer's market. Sissy loves the market. She's crazy for it. This is our third trip since I've known her. So far, she has picked up 2 albino rabbits, a giant guinea pig, and a turtle that now has its own little swimming pool. Sissy's yard is really crowded, but a cure is a cure, so we go to the farmer's market. The drive to the market is quiet. We don't say much of anything until I pull into the dusty parking lot. Then I say, there sure are a lot of things here that are going to die if someone doesn't take care of them. Sissy's eyes get really wide. No. Do you think someone will kill them? For sure, Sissy. Doomed. I hate to say stuff like this, but it has to be done. Our conversation is like this routine we pretend that we've never been through before. And besides, like I say, a cure is a cure. Oh God, Hazel, do you think that Spiny would be mad if I brought home just one thing? Oh no, not if it's not too big. Yeah, something little. How can he argue if it's just little? So we walk around the farmer's market for about an hour. Sissy gets really serious when she's making this decision. All of these animals depend on her. Well, maybe not really, but today in Sissy's head, she's definitely saving a life. We walk all the way through the market and back again. I keep Sissy away from the horses and the cows because they really are beautiful, and I know she'd want to take one home, and that just wouldn't do. As it is, every time Spiny sees us coming home from the market, he looks at me like, oh no, Hazel, not again. But then he's happy because her crazy mood has passed. That's just like Spiny. He wants everything to be okay, whatever it takes, even if he has to live in a zoo. They sell everything at the market. There's cotton candy and dishcloths right beside pigs. Then on the other side of the pigs are sausages cooking on a grill. The pigs don't seem to mind. There's also a million gadgets and fun things to look at, like old-fashioned radios and china teacups. And right beside those things are Kiss the Cook aprons and some crazy pens that light up and play a tune when you write with them. It's like the market can't make up its mind what century it's in. After a while of walking back and forth, Sissy sees this old farmer guy sitting on the tailgate of a dusty pickup. She goes over to him and looks in the back of the truck to see what he's selling. As soon as I see her face, I know that this is saved life. A chicken, Sissy? Chickens are little. Yes. Yes, they are. So she buys a chicken and a big wire cage that she can set up in her yard. I buy 6 bulbs of flowers that bloom in the fall. We carry everything back to the duster. Sissy is ecstatic. I want the chicken to go in the trunk, but she insists on putting it in the back seat so she can put the seatbelts around the cage. And when Sissy smiles and says, please, like she's doing right now, I can't say no. You did a good thing today, Sissy. I love that chicken already. What's it called, Sissy? Buck, of course. You're awful with names, Sissy. It runs in the family, she says. She gives me another big grin, and me and Sissy and Buck and 6 fall blooming bulbs head back home. When we get to the trailer, King and Spiny are waiting for us, ready to take the second shift in case Sissy is still in a mood. King has bought all kinds of ice cream treats. We eat drumsticks as Bonnie sets up the cage for Buck, and Sissy gives us all a running narration on the proper care and maintenance of chickens. Spiny is so glad to have Sissy back to normal that you would think he was happy to have that mangy chicken show up. King holds up his drumstick for a cheers and says, "Nice work, Hazel." As old Joe says, I quote, "There's nothing a little bit of sweetness can't fix."
Hazelwood, because a fire was in my head, and cut and peeled a hazel wand, and hooked a berry to a thread, and when white moths were on the wing, and moth-like stars were flickering out, I dropped a berry in a stream, and caught a little silver trout. When I had laid it on the floor, I went to blow the fire aflame, but something rustled on the floor, and someone called me by my name. It had become a glimmering girl with apple blossoms in her hair, who called me by my name and ran, and faded through the brightening air. Though I am old with wandering through hilly lands, I will find out where she has gone, and kiss her lips and take her hands, and walk among dappled grass, and pluck till time and times are done the silver apples of the moon, the golden apples of the sun.
And that was Mary Murphy, Song of the Wandering Angus. That in Old English, Song of the Wandering Angel. The poem was written by W.B. Yeats, and the music was written by Mary Murphy, who is a Canadian. And, I actually quite enjoy this. I like her voice. It's not something that someone would call necessarily a traditionally beautiful voice, but there you have it. Anyway, you heard from Tanya Chapman, and now you're about to hear some excerpts from Sugarbush. Jen Farrell, and who is a nice lady, very, very intelligent. Here you go.
Summer 1991.
Craig Thomas asked me out right at the end of the school year. He had gone out with Anne for a couple months in grade 9, but other than that, I didn't really know him that well. One minute I'm at some party, and he says he likes my Neil Young shirt. The next minute, he phones me up out of the blue and asks me to go to a baseball game. I hate baseball, but I went anyway. Later, when we were making out in the parking lot, he told me he liked my shirt because I wasn't wearing a bra. Still, he was an okay guy. He was working at the lumberyard that summer and making pretty good money, too. Me and the girls got fast food jobs for the summer. I wanted to work at the Black Forest again, like last year, but when the restaurant got sold to that mean couple and they wanted us to wear those Oktoberfest beer wench uniforms, I was like, no way. Candace's mom managed the chicken shack, and Candace told me they were still hiring summer staff, so I figured, what the hell? Wendolyn had already signed up for a summer of flipping burgers. Anne was making tacos at that New Mexican place, and Lisa was doing her third summer at the donut shop out by the truck stop. The chicken shack, which is a total ripoff of KFC, isn't a great job by any stretch of the imagination, but it's the only place I know of that lets the staff take home free food. Whatever chicken is left at the end of the night, we either have to throw out or take home with us. We're supposed to try and finish the night with nothing left over, of course, but if someone comes in right before closing and wants a snack pack, we have to cook a whole tray of chicken. Something about the full and correct loading of the fryers. I always save the honey garlic wings for my dad, because they're his favorite, even though they make his ulcer act up. The rest of the chicken I just pack up and take to parties or wherever I'm going that night. Now, when everyone sees me pull up, they cheer, "Here comes the chicken lady!" Hardy har. Between that and the creepy customers with their jokes about big breasts and juicy thighs, it's a real laugh riot. The first week I worked there, Mrs. McDonald, Candace's mom, made me clean out the grease trap. There's a giant sink in the back, and when the chicken pieces come out of the freezer, the cook has to dump them in the sink and run cold water over them while they thaw. Under the sink is the grease trap, a metal box thing that catches the gunk so it doesn't clog the pipes. Mrs. McDonald gave me a pair of rubber gloves and a bottle of cleaner that she warned me not to get on my skin. She told me a couple of years ago, one girl got a bad chemical burn when she tried to clean the grease trap in a half top. I was crawling around on the greasy floor underneath the sink forever, trying to pull the lid off the box. When I finally did, I almost threw up right there. It was full of rotten chicken fat and bits of bone and stuff. It smelled like hell and puke and death. The box doesn't come right off, so I had to scoop out all the crap with a little cup and dump it into a bucket. Then I had to close it all up again and run the super corrosive cleaner through the drains. I found out later that the only time the grease trap ever gets cleaned is when there's a new trainee. Depending on what our shifts are like, sometimes one of the girls will come and visit me during work, or I'll go visit them. The best is when we go visit Anne at the Casa Mexicana. We're all crazy for tacos, just because it's something new. Anne always gives us tons of free stuff if her manager isn't around. This one time, we all had the day off except Anne, so we smoked some hash and went to the Casa to bug her. We ended up totally pigging out and acting like total spazzes. Her manager came over and told us we better settle down or we'd have to leave. Wendolyn grabbed her fajita, pointed it at him like a gun, and said in this super serious voice, "A grilled chicken burrito, when handled properly and with the right amount of agility, can be a frightening thing." I just about pissed my pants. I was laughing so hard. Anne totally got in trouble for that later, which made me feel bad. Wen is such a nut sometimes. I don't know where she comes up with this stuff. I love the way she's not scared of anything and likes to freak everyone out. People think she's really weird, but she gets straight A's without hardly even trying. One time, in biology class, she asked Mr. Briggs if the human body was fit for consumption. Everyone was like, "Ew!" Then Gary Emmett made some stupid comment, and that was that. But you see what I mean, right? She's totally insane, but she's my best friend. Craig was turning out not to be the best boyfriend in the history of the world. For one thing, he's kind of dumb. I'm no Einstein or anything, but come on. I mean, the guy says stuff like library for library and drowned for drown. Also, he's really putting pressure on me to do it with him. He so doesn't get that I'd be like way more into the idea if he'd just let up for 5 seconds already. The minute we're alone at a party or in the movie theater, He's instantly messing around with the top button on my jeans. It makes me feel weird, because I know he's done it before, and I know I'm 16, and most girls my age have already done it like 100 times. And it's not like I haven't done practically everything else, so what's the big deal, right? I don't know. Something keeps stopping me. Maybe it's just the guys I've gone out with. We have a good time together, and they seem to like me and everything. And then when we start fooling around, it's like they go all retarded. They're so pushy. It's not like I imagined things would be when I was younger. I just don't want it to be this big goal for them, you know? I don't want Craig to paw me if all he's thinking about is getting off. I want it to be because we really like each other. Because it feels good for both of us. Because it evolves, you know? Okay, now I'm being a total loser. Just forget it. One day, it was getting close to 4 o'clock, the end of my day shift at the shack, when these huge clouds started rolling in. They were so dark, and they had this greenish cast to them that was really scary. The air got still and staticky, like it does before a big storm. Candace was covering a shift that her mom couldn't work. She was the worst employee ever. I guess because she knew her mom wouldn't fire her. She only came in when a shift needed covering anyway. From what I could tell, Candace spent most of her summer working on her tan. She told me all of her weird tanning tricks, like plugging a fan in the outlet on the deck so she didn't get too hot. She always frosted her hair and wore really thick, pale lipstick, too, so she'd look even darker. It was weird, but whatever. She had been really chubby in grade 9 and had lost a lot of weight, so I think she wanted to show it off. Some girls said she was a skank, but she always seemed okay to me. Chris, the fry cook, said he was going for a smoke break before the rain started. Let's go for a smoke break too, Candace said. But there won't be anyone out front. No shit, Sherlock. Get me a marker. Candace made a back in 5 minutes sign for the front door and cranked her Jane's Addiction CD. Her mom would have totally killed us if she knew. By the time we were ready to go out, it had already started pouring. Candace took off her work shirt and her shoes and her visor and threw them on the lid of the freezer. Come on, she said. Let's go get clean. It had been so hot all day, and I felt so stinky and greasy. I took my stuff off, too, and rolled up the legs of my beige polyester pants. It was dark out for the middle of the day. Candace and I ran around the back parking lot in our bras, yelling like freaks. The rain just made me feel slimier at first, but after a while I got used to it, and then the wetter I got, the better it felt. I could just feel all that dirty chicken grease running off me, out of my hair. Chris smoked a cigarette sitting on a milk crate in the doorway, watching and laughing. After a while, the rain made everything so clean, you couldn't even really smell the dumpster anymore. Lisa's parents went on holiday for 2 weeks in July, so we were crashing there a lot. Lisa decided to have a party while they were away. I had to work until close on Saturday, but I promised to come right after and bring chicken with me. Why don't I just spill some whiskey down my chin? Craig was going to meet me there because he only lives a few blocks from Lisa's. How come the bigger of a hurry you are to get out of somewhere, the longer and more boring it's going to be? Work was so slow, and I stood around with my thumb on my ass all day waiting for it to end. Then sure enough, right before close, a bunch of people came in and ordered buckets and salads and boxes of fries. I was running around in the back, packing up mini cheesecakes and styrofoam tubs of gravy, while Chris loaded the cookers with more chicken. People get upset when you tell them their chicken's going to take 20 minutes, but they get even more upset if they think it's been sitting in the steam cabinet for 5 hours. You can't win. Anyway, so I'm about to load in some new fries when I see that there's all this crap floating around in the fry oil, bits of old fry and breadcrumbs and stuff. It's always so scummy by Saturday because we only change the oil on Sunday nights. I grabbed the little mesh strainer thing that we use to scoop out the bits. I kept glancing through the pass-through window to the front while I'm doing it, keeping an eye on my crabby customers and hoping no more came in, when I accidentally dragged the knuckle of my index finger through the hot oil. It didn't even really hurt at first. It just felt weird. And then it hurt a lot. I quickly wrapped a rag around it, loaded the fries, and got Chris to help me pack the chicken. Then I asked him to take the stuff out to the customers and ran to the bathroom. Chris locked the door before any more people could come in, and he helped me wrap a bunch of gauze around it. Man, he said, that's really swollen. It's like one giant blister. I know, it's making me barf. Just cover it up already. I've got a party to get to. I walk into Lisa's kitchen with a bucket of chicken, and then I make a second trip out to the car for my knapsack. I thought for sure I was going to get in an accident on the way because my right hand is just screaming and I couldn't really hold the wheel. Never mind, it's blasting as usual. It's pretty good, but it's the only thing people ever listen to, so you'd think they'd be sick of it by now. Anyway, I'm more into stuff like Neil Young and Janis Joplin. In fact, I read somewhere that Southern Comfort was Janis's favorite drink, and that's why I have a 26er of it in my knapsack. I crack it open and down a couple Tylenols that Lisa brings me. Soon, my finger doesn't hurt as much, and everyone makes me take off the gauze so they can look at it. They all want to touch it. How come it's not crispy? Anne asks. Because I didn't batter it first, you retard. I don't see Craig anywhere, which is kind of weird, but I'm not too worried about it. I hang out in the kitchen for a bit, drinking and talking. Then I bum a cigarette and go out in the backyard to smoke it. I'm fishing out a pack of matches when I hear voices from the gazebo. Lisa's parents have this super corny gazebo thing that's all white wood and has seats inside. I wander over to see what's going on. It's Craig and Candace trying to entangle themselves from each other. They're not doing a good job. I can see from the tag that Candace has her shirt on backwards. Oh man, is all Craig can say. Candace just looks at me, and in the dark, I can't really decide if her face is smug or embarrassed. Maybe it's both. I turn around and walk out without saying anything. I tuck the smoke behind my ear and go back into the kitchen. I put the bucket of chicken under one arm and my 26er of comfort under the other, and I walk out the front door. No one notices or says anything. I walk the few blocks to Craig's house, smoking and taking swigs from the bottle on the way. There's no cars in their driveway. His parents must have gone to a movie or something. I start to lay the chicken pieces on the lawn, but when it takes 8 pieces just to make a decent F, I change my mind. Instead, I use a piece to write "Fuck you" in big greasy letters on Craig's living room window. I drink the rest of my bottle and toss the rest of the chicken around the garden and the roof of the carport. There's only one piece left, so I wipe my hands on my jeans and eat it on the way back to Lisa's. It's a drumstick, too. That's my favorite. Thanks.
Next up is Zoe. I think you're going to like her poetry. Please bear in mind, remember I did say this is for adults, so not going to guarantee the language. And the song that you heard just now was Skyline Jig. That was the Chieftains. And that is off their album, The Bells of Dublin. Take it away, Zoe.
Dear Molly Ringwald, you were once a heroine to the girls from the wrong side of the tracks with your slapdash perfect prom dresses and psychedelic fur soundtrack. Recently, I went on a date with a 21-year-old who didn't know who you were. This made me feel old. Fuck you, Molly Ringwald. Love, Zoe. This poem is called Judy 13. 1. Judy will not wear this sweater again, the flawless one with the 3/4 length gray sleeves and black torso. Perfect thumb holes are worn in around the wrists, familiar. She wore it today and began choking on the bus, ready to die. She coughed up the hard red candy, expelling it onto graffiti written on the silver back of the bus seat. It said, save yourself first, and I love you. Now the sweater is bad luck. She tossed it on top of the kitchen garbage before she brought it out the next morning. Her husband didn't notice. 2. She passed the funeral parlor on Marlin Road, the one between her house and her job at Stedman's department store. The undertaker outside was smoking, looked at her longer than he should as if to say, you're next, baby. He washed her ass as she sashayed quickly back home to call in sick. Bad luck. Judy rolls pennies on the plastic gingham tablecloth. 3. In the support group, there is a guy who chewed his own skin. There is a girl who fell a lot. There is a woman that Judy knew, just knew, wasn't going to make it. The therapist told Judy she was really making progress, even though she had never spoken, just smiled. 4. When Judy got home, she checked the pilot light again. Again, 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 again. She noticed a hole in her left sock. 5. Obsessed, prepossessed, infatuated, fixated, besotted, gripped, held, monomaniacal, a visionary. 6. Her husband never, ever worried about anything. Sometimes when he was broke, he would sigh a little bit. Nothing to get all tense about, Judy, he said as he washed the carrots and set them aside. He rubbed a long one against the square metal grater. She knew he wasn't worried about death or disease, the possibility of both, just the shreds of orange falling into the ceramic bowl. Sometimes that made Judy dream about chewing wine glasses. 7. Judy played harmonica in the window. The lady downstairs in the yard looked up. Her eyes were penny whistles. 8. Judy said, heaven forbid, whenever she thought about having sex with everybody on the bus. The old man, the girl with braces, she couldn't stop it. She said, heaven forbid, without thinking she was saying it. It just came. 9. Fatalistic, skeptical, negative, dubious, abrogating, neutralizing, pessimistic. 10. The doctor said, people with your condition either kill themselves or go on medication. She took the script into the candy store, bought red licorice, felt lighter. 11. Judy's mother telephoned every Monday night after bingo. How are you, sweetheart? Nothing to complain about, you know, same old. 12. Judy remembered when God was a petal pulled in want, a first, second, third, two, a tangible fish, when God was God, period, not God, question mark. This is, let's see, actually maybe I'll read one I've never read before, I'm not sure how it's going to go over. This is called Law and Order, an Erotic Primer. Anyone a Law and Order fan? It begins with Jill Hennessy as Assistant District Attorney Claire Kincaid. In the early years, when AIDS and reverse racism were de rigueur, her Grace Jones intonation plus the perfect single cocked brow equals hungry for righteousness, a claim, a sensible brown suit, the front steps of the courthouse in the criminal justice system. We were rapt while she pined for D.A. McCoy, who could tie a cherry stem around a jury's tongue the way he spoke, doc, evidence, objection. We spoke back, doc, evidence, objection. He knew who to kill for the killing, and after, with a solid nod towards justice, stroll straight into the smoke-soaked cop bar, resigned, thoughtful, virile, godlike, Mr. Wolf, godlike. In the age of the Special Victims Unit, oh, Olivia, there is a masterful masculinity, a minty breath manipulation, the spine-straight episodic triumphs over misogyny. He melts through pixels, the detective with the muscles and the bad marriage. His anger managed fitfully the way his fist lands on the side of good,
always, the way he serves and protects. She was a single mother, twist, a sociopath. Say it slow. The people are represented by two equally law and order. It was your first, before I gleaned any fundamental forensic tan line quasi-knowledge from CSI Miami. Oh, Horatio, take those shades off slowly. Say it slower, like you're reading a flashcard in a 70s porno. I think it was his time to die. I cut my teeth on Claire and Jack, my moral core sculpted at 7 p.m. in syndication. Watch them on Omni One, take note. In bed, say to your lover, tell me what to do now, Jack. Say it slower, harder, more. Yeah, these are their stories.
And there you have it. A wonderful evening of reading and you name it. And look at this. Ugh, my time is gone. Anyway, if you want any information about these books, titles, authors, anything like that, you can call the station 519-884-2567. I will be here. And I will be happy to answer those questions for you. Also, next week I will be giving these books away because next week I will be talking about a wonderful game. So this week, my suggestions for Christmas presents are The Poems of Emily Valentine, King, and Sugarbush. And I think a book is always a great Christmas gift. Next week, we will be talking about a wonderful, wonderful game. And it's a Trivial Pursuit type game. All the questions are about women, and it's called All About Eve. So join me next week when I will be talking to one of the ladies who came up with a game and did all this research. And in the meantime, here we go. We've got a little Ancestral Voices, Scott McCauley. You can also email me at coffeeteamamad@yahoo.ca, and I will happily give you any of the information you have. In any case, ciao, Bella.
Hedri